international trade deals, back-to-school shopping, and water balloons. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, July 17th. Good to have you with us. Looks like there's going to be a lot of trade news out of Washington, D.C. this week. On Wednesday, trade reps from China and the U.S. will meet. More on that in a minute. But first, the U.S. Trade Representative announced this afternoon the administration's objectives for renegotiating NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The release of the objectives means negotiations can start next month. Those objectives include strengthening labor and environmental obligations and eliminating what they call unfair subsidies. President Trump has called NAFTA the worst trade deal ever, citing factory jobs moved out of the country. But the plan appears to try to hold on to what farmers and ranchers got out of the deal. Mexico and Canada now account for over a quarter of U.S. farm exports. The Trump administration's new plan calls for maintaining, quote, existing reciprocal duty-free market access for agricultural goods. Marketplace's Annie Baxter starts us off.
NAFTA has been overwhelmingly beneficial to U.S. agriculture, according to Veronica Nye. She's an economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation.
Our trade with our NAFTA partners increased from about $9 billion in 1993 to $38 billion in 2016.
Some ag interests, like dairy, still want to see more trade barriers fall away, particularly with Canada. But a lot of ag groups hope President Trump will leave well enough alone. The U.S. is Mexico and Canada's biggest supplier of red meat. Joe Sheely, with the U.S. Meat Export Federation, credits NAFTA and its aftermath.
Largely, the trade barriers for red meat have been eliminated. So we don't see much opportunity for further improvement.
U.S. Grains Council President Tom Slate says NAFTA's also been good for corn, barley, and sorghum producers. If you had your wish list, like how could you actually gain from a NAFTA renegotiation?
Well, it's kind of hard to gain on a 98% market share for our products, so...
There may not be much to gain, but there's lots to lose. Jeffrey Shaw is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says if Mexico and Canada don't like the Trump administration's plans on altering, say, trade of manufactured goods, that could have consequences.
If you restrict access to manufacturers in the U.S. market, we're going to restrict access to U.S. farm products in our markets.
The agriculture lobby is also worried about other trade policies under the Trump administration. The Trans-Pacific Partnership that we backed out of earlier this year could have improved their profits by billions of dollars. And some producers fear retaliation if the U.S. imposes tariffs on steel imports. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
As we mentioned at the top, the Trump administration is also talking trade with China this week. We're expecting more details on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the Chinese economy continues to grow, 6.9% last quarter. But behind that growth is a sort of sluggishness. Productivity is at a standstill in China. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more.
6.9% GDP growth is not bad for a developing country like China. But you know what? It's not that good either.
I don't think it's anything to celebrate at this point.
Harry Broadman teaches at Johns Hopkins. If you look at where most of this growth is coming from, it's coming from government investment in basically dinosaur industries.
The industrial state enterprises, steel and coal and infrastructure spending.
These are not the future, and they're not adding to China's productivity. That is, its economic efficiency. Lauren Brandt teaches economics at the University of Toronto.
What we've been seeing in China, certainly after 2007, 2008, is a very marked decline in productivity growth.
In the past, half of China's economic growth was fueled by the fact that on a very basic level, the economy was becoming more efficient, he says. Not anymore.
Economy-wide, it looks as if productivity growth has totally disappeared.
The big reason, says Brandt?
Reform has stalled in a variety of ways.
The government is taking a breather from making its economy more efficient. This goes back to those dinosaur industries the state keeps investing in. Daniel Rosen is with the Rhodium Group.
State-owned enterprises have much lower profit margins, lower returns on investment than the private sector does.
China's government says it doesn't want these clunkers to stick around forever, but it's having trouble letting go. Again, Lauren Brandt.
Bad firms do not exit. They just kind of continue to kind of linger and remain.
They remain because they get support in one way or another from the government. There's a term for these, zombie firms. And like zombies, They're eating the brains out of China's economic growth. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was the Mondays. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Vice President Pence is expected to meet with members of the retail industry tomorrow. They'll be talking about the headwinds they face, especially the brick and mortar stores. This year, JCPenney has closed up stores. So is Sears, Macy's. Top of mind for a lot of retailers right now is the back-to-school shopping season, which seems to have arrived already, at least at my local Target. They've sold off the patio furniture and pool floaties and replaced them with backpacks and notebooks. But today's back-to-school shopping season isn't what it once was. Mark Cohen is the director of retail studies at Columbia Business School. Before that, he was the CEO of Sears Canada. Hey, Mark, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
What was it like in the heyday of back-to-school shopping? What did that look like from a retailer's perspective?
Well, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, mom would stock up on all the things that she felt her kids were going to need for the upcoming school season. Retailers would create very, very powerful, all-encompassing promotions for all things kids. So there was this holiday during the summer or early fall, which mirrored the actual Christmas season for kids' products.
How is it different today? What do these retail sales look like now?
First of all, years ago, kids started to insinuate that they wanted in on the decision as to what they were going to be wearing. And so there were actually two back-to-school events. Kids would wait until school actually started, check out what their friends were wearing.
Mom would
come back to the store and complete the ride. But you see, the promotions that were once a year that were strikingly aggressive and attractive now occur all year round. So the motivation to show up and shop certainly has dissipated enormously.
That's interesting. So the fact that all the stores have sales all the time means that I'm less likely to go out shopping in this time period that retailers used to count on me shopping as a mom.
If the deal is going to be available to you and the merchandise is going to be available all year round, what's the motivation to make this extraordinary trip to the mall and spend an enormous amount of money all at once?
Are people still buying the same amount of stuff, though, just over a broader period? So is it actually like hurt the bottom line of these retailers not to have this big promotional set of time?
There's no shortage of kids, and kids and their parents are not walking around without wearing any clothes. They're not walking around barefoot. So the demand side of the equation still is intact, but the consumer's acquisition of all of this stuff now takes place throughout the entire year. And then, of course, there is the intrusiveness of the internet.
You worked back in Sears. You did lots of back-to-school with Sears, right?
Yes, and other retailers, yes.
What was your best memory of that time as a retailer?
Well, years ago, I worked for Mervyn's, which was based in California. Mervyn's had an enormous kids business, kids apparel and accessories. And we treated back to school just like Christmas, very carefully calibrated our stores, inventory, and staffing to coincide with the actual school districts opening throughout the markets that Mervyn's serve. Mm-hmm. And so we were ready for it, and that's the heart and soul of retailing. It's ringing the bell for the parade that you're going to put on for your customers. It's the excitement of retail that I think, unfortunately, has diminished to some degree, especially in physical retailing.
Mark Cohen is Director of Retail Studies at Columbia Business School. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Explore exploring what happens when communities lose jobs that are hard to replace, jobs that have been around for generations. It's an ongoing series we're calling Way of Life. Chicago once supplied the country with meat. The Chicago stockyards gave birth to modern food processing. But today, that sector is also fading. WBEZ's Natalie Moore tells us how Chicago's work culture is shifting as the food industry has dwindled.
I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win.
Laid-off Nabisco workers and their union supporters protested last year after Nabisco stopped making Oreos at the Chicago plant and moved hundreds of jobs to Mexico. The parent company, Mondelez, says it wanted to invest in an upgraded facility there. Anthony Jackson is one of the pink-slipped workers. He bakes snacks familiar to many American pantries, Saltine, Ritz, and Honey Graham crackers.
Actually, I worked in every department except for sanitation there. I worked in the packing department. I worked as an icer mixer, a mixer helper on the mixing floor. I've worked on the bake floor.
Nabisco employed Jackson for almost 5 years at $26 an hour. His work is part of an ingrained tradition of Chicago food workers who held good jobs, were able to buy a house, and perhaps send their children to college.
We were always thought of as a working-class city, city with broad shoulders.
On a warm day on the southwest side, the scent of sweet Nabisco treats drifts into nearby homes. On the west side, the smell of Fannie Mae and Brock candies used to tickle noses. A less fragrant odor was just a few miles away decades ago. Local historian Dominic Pasiga grew up in the South Side Back of the Yards neighborhood.
Remember, as a kid, we used to have this little rhyme, roses are red, violets are blue, the stockyards stink, and so do you.
During World War I, 50,000 jobs filled that square mile. Originally, generations of white ethnic families toiled in those slaughterhouses. Pasiga says nearby South Side neighborhoods felt the economic decline when the Chicago Union Stockyard closed in 1971.
It just undercut Inglewood, which was primarily an African-American community, but a lot of African-American packing house workers in Inglewood and in Bronzeville. And all that sort of just disappeared very quickly.
Chicago and Illinois have lost multiple food manufacturers in recent years, including a General Mills and Tyson Foods plant. In 2000, the state had more than 47,000 food manufacturing jobs. That number has dipped by the thousands and hasn't gotten back to that level. Policy analysts say the state creates a lot of red tape and regulations for the food industry, though supporters say those changes are needed for environmental safety and health. Over on the near west side of Chicago, the meatpacking district is shrinking, giving way to glitterati restaurants and tech companies. Google Chicago headquarters is on a cobblestone street in which horses helped transport meat back in the day. The meatpacking Mealy Foods is in the shadow. Jorge Sanchez works in sales. In two decades, he's seen dozens of meat businesses leave.
It's becoming a yuppie neighborhood, uptrend, restaurants.
The hot real estate market is pushing the food industry out. Roaring trucks and wholesale chicken distributors don't fit in with the new motif. Sanchez says Neely is moving to another part of the city. But food isn't totally leaving this neighborhood. McDonald's Corporation is in the process of moving its headquarters from a Chicago suburb to this hot area. In Chicago, I'm Natalie Moore from Marketplace.
Coming up?
At one point, I was stuffing mini marshmallows inside the balloon.
Reinventing summer fun. But first, let's do the numbers. All flat, flat, flat today. Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 8 points, less than 0.1%, to finish at 21,629. The Nasdaq was up just 1 point, barely moving to end at 6314, and the S&P 500 pretty much unchanged to end at 2459. Consumer products giant Procter & Gamble is not making enough money, so says activist investor Nelson Peltz. His Trion Fund Management Company owns $3 billion of stock, and he's pushing for a board seat. A showdown Omicron is looming, shares up 0.5%. And you got a feel for Blue Apron today. The meal kit company went public, just about 2 weeks ago. And now a British newspaper reports Amazon prepping its own meal kit service. Blue Apron's share price cooled 10%, while Amazon heated up 0.8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.31%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. By and large, it's been a good decade for solar power. According to an industry group, solar energy capacity has grown 1,600% over the last 8 years. But recently, solar has struggled, especially companies making and installing home solar panels. Firms Suniva, Sungevity, Solar World have all filed for bankruptcy. Inside Energy's Dan Boyce checks out one reason why.
Nancy Kotz is walking her German Shepherd through the Table Rock Ridge subdivision.
This is Sarah.
It's a sunny morning here in the foothills near Golden, Colorado. Useful, because every one of these stately homes has solar panels.
The houses in this neighborhood came automatically with them. You didn't get a choice.
The subdivision's developer required it. Kotz is okay with that. She moved here a year ago, and
our energy bills are really cheap compared to California.
That's one of the core arguments for buying a rooftop solar system, right? Save the planet, save money too. All that rooftop power is free. And then, through so-called net metering programs, whatever you don't use, you can sell back to the utility. Sweet. Except some states are changing that model, as Arizona residents recently learned on the local news.
The Arizona Corporation Commission just made a major decision that is going to impact anybody thinking about putting solar panels on their home.
In Arizona, Maine, Hawaii, and most recently Indiana, utility commissioners and state legislators have rolled back or reduced these net metering programs. Ashley Brown of Harvard University's Electricity Policy Group says net metering is usually far too generous.
It pays a premium price well above market and substantially above costs.
Brown stresses utilities have a lot of fixed costs. Every time a solar customer buys less power, the utility has to shift the burden of those fixed costs onto other, often poorer customers.
Kind of Robin Hood in reverse.
Brown says net metering laws were put in place to lure customers when solar panels were much more expensive. Now, consumers benefit from bargain basement Chinese panels flooding the market. Despite those rapidly falling prices, Bloomberg New Energy Finance predicts a 2% drop in rooftop installations this year. I know. Huh? And this for an industry used to growing a lot year over year.
Yeah, this is really a temporary blip from 2016 to 2017.
Solar entrepreneur Jigar Shah points to a couple reasons. Many companies have been scaling back marketing this year after spending far too much on things like television spots, billboards, and ads plastered in Amtrak trains.
Solar really is a technology that has to be sold face to face. You can't sell it over the phone or over the internet.
And there's been a sort of saturation in California, solar's biggest state. Still, Shah remains bullish. He thinks companies will adjust their marketing strategies and start growing again next year. He's also not worried about some states rolling back their net metering policies. Others are doing just the opposite. Nevada, for example, just reinstated its net metering program.
More markets are open today than have ever been open before.
Regardless of how rooftop solar is sold, Ashley Brown from Harvard says if we really want to stop climate change, we need to change our thinking.
By far, the least cost-effective way of reducing carbon in our environment is rooftop solar.
Way better, he says, to go big, utility-scale solar projects or wind farms. Back at Table Rock Ridge, resident Nancy Kotz says having panels on her roof just makes her feel good, as long as they're not too obvious.
I wouldn't like it if I walked outside and I saw these big panels in front of my house and it took away from the look.
But hers are on the back of the house, she says. You can't really see them. I'm Dan Boyce for Marketplace.
If you've got a kid, kid, you've probably seen these self-tying water balloons in the store, maybe at a neighbor's party. They're called Buncha balloons, and they look like a couple dozen balloons on long, skinny tubes. You attach them to your hose, the balloons fill with water, and when you shake the hose, they fall off, all tied and ready to toss. They bring us to this latest installment of what we call Summer, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by
Buncha Balloons is produced by Zuru and sold in countries around the world. Inventor Josh Malone came up with the idea. We reached him in Plano, Texas. Josh, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Where'd the idea come from?
Well, it came from thousands and thousands of water balloons that I filled one at a time and tied with my fingers. So just spent many hours thinking there's got to be a better way to do this.
How did it come to you? How did you sort of figure out to do it like this?
Well, I would just, you know, I would develop concepts in my head about how can we do this differently. And I tinkered around with some different things. At one point, I was stuffing mini marshmallows inside the balloon. Anyway, things like that. And then eventually I thought, can I just put a small elastic ring around the neck of the balloon to seal it? And started working on that idea, wasn't satisfied, set it aside for a year or two, and then it was the middle of winter, but I had some free time, and I pulled back out the concept of this elastic ring around the neck of the balloon, and I was able to get a ring around a balloon, and then I realized I got to figure out how to get the water into it because it was closed. So I thought if I put a small tube in there, I can pry it open and then insert the water through the tube, and then I looked at the other end of the tube, and so I had to figure out how to get the water into there. So I found one of the caps that goes on the end of a garden hose.
Right.
I put a hole in it. I put the tube in it. And then I looked at it and I thought, that tube's really lonely. There's all this room for more tubes. And rather than test it, I immediately filled the end of the cap with holes. I calculated you could fit 37 holes in the end of that cap and glued the tubes in and took it outside and connected to the hose and filled it up. And it was magical. They filled up and fell off and sealed themselves. It just worked. And I thought, maybe this solves a problem for a lot more people than just myself.
I mean, did you at that moment, was it a little bit like winning the lot? Like you just felt like you figured it out? You got it?
No, it was more like cautious optimism.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I've had plenty of ideas and some of them turned into products. And boy, the road ahead after that is just fraught with peril.
I mean, in your experience, what's harder? Is it actually having that idea and bringing it to life? Or is it getting through the production and marketing process?
The production and marketing process is always harder. And I think most inventors come to realize that pretty early in their careers.
Why is
that? So the idea is just the 80-20 principle. So 20% is the idea and the 80% is the production and marketing and finance and everything else.
What's it like broadly to be an inventor in the U.S. today?
Well, there's aspiring inventors and they enjoy it. And there's always that potential and that hope. And then there's those of us that have been moderately successful and, you know, gotten a product to market and maybe sold it business to business or sold it on a few retail shelves.
This has got to count as more than a moderate success, right?
Yeah, this was just the home run times 100. I mean, this was just unbelievable, overwhelming. I have no expectation of being able to do this again. There's just too many things that had to fall into place that were out of my control. And I could have screwed it up in a lot of different ways, but still a lot of things went my way to be this successful.
What's the production like now? I mean, if you can just ballpark it for me, how many of these things are you guys making and selling?
It's a little over 2 million packs per month. We've produced over 2.5 billion balloons in the last 2.5 years.
Do you still go out and throw water balloons these days?
Yes.
Yeah? You're not over it? Like I could never see another water balloon and it'd be okay?
No, you know, we have we take a break for a while, but it's always fun to do when you're hot and you want to throw something. And if there's at least one other participant, it's still a fun time.
Josh Malone is the inventor of Buncha Balloons. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This final note before we go today. Sounds like credit card payment companies have realized something most of the rest of us already know. That beep, beep, beep sound that chip readers make at the end of a purchase is deeply, truly annoying. According to Bloomberg, the payment company Verifone is the country's largest maker of payment terminals, and it's developed new sounds to replace the beep. Sounds like these. Not sure those are any better. Apparently, swapping out the beep will take months. Verifone expects customers might start noticing changes this fall. Today, the Dow lost 8 points, less than 0.1%. The Nasdaq was up just 1 point, barely moving, and the S&P 500 pretty much unchanged. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll see you all tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.